Welcome to the One Stiletto in the Grave podcast with your hosts, Sonny Ormond and Jane James.
Well, happy new year, you lovely listeners. We're back and we have a stellar guest on our show today. Was that a clue? Well, think dragons, castles, Caerphilly cheese and corgis. Think Barry Island. Have you guessed it yet? Well, all will be revealed. So kick off your shoes, snuggle down on your beanbags, and be delighted by this tidy Celtic queen. Now, Janie and I are thrilled to be joined today by an award-winning national treasure. An actress, comedian, writer, producer, novelist, avid Archers listener. Oh, yes, and probably a little-known fact, a one-time member of the Girls' Nautical Corps. It's Ruth Jones.
Hello.
Hello, welcome. Welcome, Ruth.
We will want to know much more about Girls' Nautical Corps later. But first of all, we know that you're an Archers fan. How long have you been listening?
Oh gosh, I think I started listening when I was at university, so that's mid-80s. I did a radio drama module, and that's when I started listening to Radio 4 drama, really. And then I think it was around that time, so that would have been, yeah, sort of mid-80s. But I think properly I started in about 1991, I started listening. So yeah, I've been listening for, how many years is that? I'm terrible at maths. 30-something years, is it?
Some, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
A long time.
Yes.
So, what keeps you listening now? I mean, what is it about the programme that you enjoy so much?
Don't start me off, because I'm literally, sometimes I get really cross with it. I'm not going to lie. I get really cross. Like, I go, why did you start us off on that story and then we never found out what happened? Why did you get rid of Jennifer so brutally? Why, you know, why don't we know who's moved into the Aldridge's home? I mean, why would Brian and Jennifer sell the house just because Kate was having a tantrum? That sort of thing. So I do get really obsessed with it, but I just love it. It's like my comfort place. I love, and people say to me, would you like to be in the Archers? Oh, good God, no. That would spoil it. Because for me, Ambridge really, really exists. And although I know what a radio studio looks like, the thought of being, I mean, I honestly, when I listen to it, I visualise the whole village, the whole place. So I couldn't, it would ruin it for me to be in it.
It's so interesting you say that, because obviously being in it, I still can listen to it, because I tend to try and listen if I can to the omnibus always. And I can lose myself in it, even though I'm in it and I know what that studio looked like, you know, and I know whether I still, it's the power of the imagination somehow that allows me, even though I know what it actually looks like physically, to immerse myself in this imaginary world. It's fascinating, actually.
Yeah, it is. You know? And I think that's the power of radio, isn't it? I mean, radio is so, the way that it can transport you, you can go absolutely anywhere in the universe in radio. Mm. And I just do, I do find that connection really, really powerful. And Lillian, I have to say that you are really, I would say, definitely my top three favourite characters. I just called you Lillian. There we are. You see, I called you Lillian and not Sunny. So that just shows
how...
All right,
darling. I'm used to it. It's all right.
I just think she's an absolute breath of fresh air. And I loved it when... You see, you shouldn't start me off in the Archers. I loved it when... I loved those the bubbles, the not the bubbles, the Archers... What was it called? The Archers, the sort of spin-offs that they did years ago.
On Radio 4 Extra.
Yes.
And
Lillian went to... No, she didn't go to Russia. Didn't Matt go to Russia or something?
Matt went to Russia, yes. That's right, yeah.
Yes.
And it was terribly dramatic. And
hugely dramatic. Mm. And the only thing about... I did listen to them, but I didn't like going inside their heads. And I know during COVID that obviously there were huge constraints on recording. And that was the only time I didn't really listen, because I couldn't bear being inside the head of any of the characters. Mm. I felt intrusive somehow and rude. Mm. So I didn't want to go.
No, it's interesting because I think they did that to try, the idea initially was to try and win over a younger audience, is my understanding of it. Because initially, I think it was a lot of the very younger characters within the show, and then it developed into other stories as well. But no, it was interesting that, and I do remember a debate at the time about those inner monologues and whether they should be used or not. So it's interesting, really, what you're saying. But no, it was such good fun. And I think it was financial reasons, basically, why it was sort of pulled in the end. But we had a fabulous time. And in fact, there was a big outcry because Matt and Lillian split up, but on Radio 4 Extra, not in the main Archers. And a lot of people weren't listening to that. I do remember there's a terrible hoo-ha about all that. And my lips are sealed about it, but...
Also, now there's something that happened in one of those episodes, which is that Jazza spent the night with Fallon. They had a night of passion in a van, and that's never alluded to.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just think that things like that, I mean, I love that about the Archers, and I love the way that they can start a story, you know, something can happen years ago, and it, unlike with television soaps, because I don't watch any television soaps, the Archers is the only soap that I know and love. They would start something, like, say, for example, when John's son appeared out of, you know, and that story that came back to life from years ago. I just thought that was really clever, and I think that's what the Archers does really well, is it sort of nurtures stories and lets them kind of bubble away, and then they come to the surface. And that's what I really think it's at its best.
Yeah. That's right. Seeds are sown.
They are. I mean, the classic one, I suppose, is Rob and Helen, isn't it? Because that unfolded kind of in real time. And we were all not sure for a while.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that was... I remember going into... I had to go to Radio 4 for something during that time. And I was going... And it was just before they had the verdict. And I was going... I was in the radio drama department, and there were a couple... There was a producer there and somebody else who worked there. And I was going, I'm serious. You cannot let her be found guilty. I said... Oh, that's right. I'll stop listening, as if that's going to make any difference. Stop listening if she's found guilty. And I said, and also the other time I did it was when David Archer, I actually wrote to Tim Bentinck, and I just said, if their farm gets sold, do you remember when it was going to, the road was going to go through and all that? Yeah. If the farm gets sold, I am going to stop listening. I just want you to know that. I feel so... Oh no, we better not, because Ruth Jones is going to stop listening. But that's how much I love it.
I know. I know. Would you like to write for it, Ruth?
Oh, sometimes I would. But then, again, it's a similar sort of thing to being in it in a way, because, again, I just feel that they're real people, and I'd be, I don't know. It would sort of spoil it for me, I think.
So... who do you think is Lillian's true love? Do you think it's Matt or do you think it's Justin?
Well, what about, what's his name? The brother?
Oh, Paul.
Oh, well, yeah. Paul.
Was it Paul?
It was Paul.
That was really lovely, that relationship.
Very,
wasn't
very
it?
Full on. And it was interesting for me as an actor, because when they decided to create that storyline, I thought, oh, God, this is really interesting, because actually she was devoted to Matt. But of course, you know, he really didn't give her the love that she wanted. In my mind, when Paul came along, the reason that she did it was because he looked terribly like Matt. And so it was the other side of the coin. You know, as an actor, you try and find what is driving me, what's my motive, because I want to make this truthful. And I thought, that's what it is. He is providing her with all the things that Matt can't give her, but she really, it's Matt that she really loved. But so it was interesting for me to find a way through it. Because sometimes you're given storylines, aren't you, and things, and you think, oh, hang on a minute, am I going to make this work, you know? And it's just...
Yes.
But anyway, But Paul, she adored him.
Paul... I just thought the whole Matt and Lillian as a combination were really exciting and interesting as a couple as well. You know, the whole pussycat thing, and I loved it when he appeared. Then there've been some great, there've been some really great characters. I actually wrote to the Archers the other day because I said, look, to the production office, I said, I'm sorry, why has Bert suddenly reappeared when he's dead? And you're talking about Bert in the pub. And of course they were talking about Bert Horobin.
Horobin, yeah.
But Bert Horobin's never been called Bert Horobin. He's always called Dad or Grandpa. He's never. So, no, there, oh, well, there are some great, I love as well. Yeah.
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 There's always been a sort of rule that you can't have two people with the same first name in Ambridge, haven't there?
Yeah.
Precisely because of that, I guess.
Yeah, well, and yet in real life, of course, you have loads of people with the same name. We in Stella, when we did this series for Sky, we had Di Davis. We made a thing of it. There were two characters called Di, which I mean, you get millions of Dies in Wales, and so we had a whole thing. Di Davis or Di
Koch?
Which you know, moving on. Just adore it. I mean, adore all your work anyway. But funny enough, I've been watching a load of Stella's today. They're such clever characters, Ruth. I just, even the smallest characters, they're just so beautifully formed. I was just saying to Janie, like the girl who's in the hotel, who's the waitress, and it's coffee players. I mean, you're just the tiniest. You know, just so brilliant. Oh, brilliant. But with that, though, I'm just fascinated. I mean, how much time is spent? Is it the way you're casting, or how much time is spent directing people? Or where do those fabulous, the writing, of course, is it all there in the writing before you begin?
Well, it's funny because you met that character. It was actually based on a real waitress. When I was a student, when I would come home in the holidays, I waitressed in a local hotel, and I used to have to sort of follow the main waitress, and she would go around, and she used to say, she would do silver service, and I would be there with a gravy behind her. She'd do service, and she'd go, carrots, please, potatoes, please. That's where it came from, a direct lift. From there,
brilliant.
And some, I mean, some, but then some actors brilliantly make things their own. So we had a nursing instructor in series three called Cheryl, and she was just like she naturally had a really lovely Ron the Valleys accent, and she just made more of what we'd written. You know, so sometimes it's a combination of both, really. But a lot of it is observation, I suppose, and just I'm a bit of it's not Pollyanna, but I think there's so much awfulness in the world that I like to write worlds that are where people like each other.
Yes,
and you know what I mean. And there's a bit more positivity going on. So I think a lot of it comes from that. I like daftness. Daft
is good. Stella's just brilliant. Please tell me that Paula is based on a real person, because then I just kind of want to. She's brilliant.
I just
love her.
Those scenes, they are
the alcoholic undertaker.
Yeah. I know, breathalyzing stuff before she takes the hearse out. It's just genius, Ruth.
It is. It is genius.
So funny.
With that character, because obviously she appears in the very first episode of Stella, and when I wrote that, because we'd had a kind of an idea of so me and my husband we kind of created the we had the concept for it, but I sort of wrote that first episode and I just didn't really know what it was going to be. All I knew was that she was a single mum who had a son by somebody when she was 16. The father of the son went off to Canada, and then she went on to marry and have two more kids. And that's all I knew. And so when it came to bringing, I knew she would need a confidant and a best friend. And I thought, it'd be good if she was an undertaker. And at that point, I didn't know if she was going to be an alcoholic, a functioning alcoholic. So I thought, I'll have a call round to a customer who's, to talk about funeral arrangements. So she knocks on this guy's door and he answers it. And she says, I've come to, it's about your mother. I've come to measure her up. And he goes, oh, yes, you better come in. And she's like sitting there going, and so where is she? She's upstairs. And so they have this whole conversation and they discuss what the coffin is going to be like and what sort of lining do you want, silk or satin or leather? And they go, oh, my God. And then they go into this huge snog and they start snogging and then they go upstairs. And I thought, oh, I really like that idea that she would just get off with a customer, like a grieving customer. And then I thought, oh, I know, I'll take it a step further. And maybe they could actually be married. And this is like a sex game that they do. He could be Stella's brother. So it sort of like goes, so I had no plan. It just all kind of happened sort of organically. Really.
Organically.
And it's just so funny that you know, Stella, sort of every now and then she comes round and they're in the middle of some horrendous sex game.
I know.
And she's sort of presented with a view of her brother's bum. And it's just...
Yes. And Big Al witnesses it. I remember one time through a letterbox. I don't think he was ever the same since. You know, wonderful. And of course, Daddy, who... everybody else understands.
God, I love
Daddy. We understand not a word of him. I mean, it's such a clever concept.
He was based on a neighbour from where we used to live years ago. And we could never understand a word he said because he mumbled. So he'd go, oh, hello, John. Yeah, how are you today? Well, right. And literally couldn't understand what he said. So what we wanted to do with Daddy was have it that everybody else understood what he was saying, but the audience wouldn't know. And it's my father used to get really annoyed with it. Why don't they put it on the subtitles? I can't understand the word he's saying. Used to get really, really cross. It was played by the wonderful Howell Evans, who's no longer with us.
Oh.
And he did it so brilliantly. Yeah. And he had such a great through line in the series because he died in series two and had the funeral. And we had this whole process where Paula was the grieving daughter and she asked for all these items to be put in the coffin according to what Daddy had wanted. And they do the checklist and two pennies for his eyes and a candle and a mobile phone and all these kind of things that he wanted in there. And then, you know, in the middle of the service, this phone starts ringing and Paula gets really cross because whose phone is it? And she looks at her own mobile phone and it says Daddy. And it's like, oh, my God. And then we did actually have him. He did actually then die in a later series. And because Howell had never really had the chance to speak coherently as the character of Daddy, we decided to give him a twin brother. So the twin brother came to Daddy's funeral and he was able to give a eulogy, which was lovely to hear Howell actually speak for the first time. But he quoted Daddy and quoted him in Daddy speak.
Oh, brilliant.
And everybody in the congregation started laughing, like, oh, yes, that's really funny. The viewing audience wouldn't have a clue what he was saying. So, it was really good fun. It was really good.
The other funeral I remember is, I think it's in the first series, where I can't even think whose funeral it is, and Neil Kinnock delivers the eulogy.
Brilliant.
And he was so funny.
He was so funny.
Yeah. That was, we had a fictitious... rugby player called Dick the Kick.
That's it.
And we managed to get loads of the Welsh rugby team came. Mike Phillips was there and Shane Williams. And we even had Warren Gatlin, the coach. There's a close-up of him. I mean, it was amazing, really, that we had all these people. And, yeah, Neil Kinnock, who just was so funny. He was really, really got great comic timing, actually.
Yes, it was superb. So how much, and I suppose maybe this applies to Gavin and Stacey as well. I mean, I know with Victoria Wood, a script was written and it was sacrosanct and you couldn't change anything. How do you feel that with your scripts? What is your attitude with that?
I suppose with Gavin and Stacey, we were quite strict about changing anything because James and I are both actors and we would read the script in character. So we would, once we'd got them finished, we would then go back over them and really become quite detailed about the delivery and what the actual lines were. And to be fair, the actors were really respectful of that, and they didn't. I can't really remember them wanting to change anything. I mean, maybe here and there they would, but and of course, again with that, the actors brought so much to it. I mean, Alison Steadman just is genius, the way she can just bring a character to life. You know, we did have her in mind when we were writing it, and I suppose that helped, but we didn't know what exactly she was going to do with it. And then characters like, say, Dave Coaches, he was only ever meant to be in one episode.
Oh, was he?
Yeah. But Stefan Rodri, who played him, just so brilliant. And he did that kind of that real sort of dry Cardiff, like fags and weed, glue and speed, but I draws the line at crack. And just, he was so good the way he delivered it. We just thought, oh, we've got to see more of him. And he ended up being a really major part in the whole series, you know. So it's a lovely process when you see what actors bring to it. But they vary, to go back to what you were asking, Sunny, they people generally are very unless we would always be open to changing things if we felt it didn't work, but I think we'd worked so closely on the script that we felt it was up to speed. You know, I've worked with Steve Coogan, and he's often very up for improvisation, or Julia Davis up for improvisation, and I suppose it just depends on how you like to work, really.
And I think it's interesting because both you and James are actors, and that was the way that you would look at your scripts and you would read them out loud, because actors have a natural kind of rhythm. You know what your character's rhythm is going to be. So hopefully then by the time you pass the script on to the actors, you've already played around with that rhythm. You've got it. You've secured it, really, which is the difference, I think, when actors write. One's got to be a bit careful what one says. But, you know, sometimes with scripts, things are not sayable, you know. You know what I mean, in certain scripts. I don't mean, you know, one's got to be careful.
I know. That's a really good point. And the one thing I always think is quite interesting, and I find this when I'm writing. So I think I can write good dialogue, but my plots are not always as good. I think my dialogue's better than my plots. But anyway, I think one thing, I often say this to people when they're just sort of, you know, if they're asking about writing, I say, one thing that really bugs me is when people put somebody's name in, when they're talking to them, in their sentence. Because the thing is, Jane, if I use your name, or if I use your name, Sunny, it sounds like almost like a little bit punitive, or you're telling somebody off. It has a particular effect. And so when you read it in dialogue, in a script or in a book where they have it, you go, why are you using their name? You wouldn't use that person's name in real life. And things like that, I think, are important. Or if you're telling, you know, doing too much telling and explaining, and that on the nose writing, which you can just hear. I think The Archers is a really, sometimes, and I have no idea who writes The Archers. I don't know any names of writers or anything. So I you know, I'm not going to put my foot in it, but there are times where I just can hear the difference from week to week. And sometimes I just go, oh my God, that episode was so brilliantly written. And it's really fascinating, actually.
Things can be overwritten. Yes. You can be much more economical in a way, can't you? You know, and I think it's allowing the actor to then create more dimension. I mean, I think that is so interesting, and that's what I love about your dialogue and the different characters that you've created. Your Gavin and Stacey, Stella. I suppose that's why they feel so well formed. If you haven't, because obviously you didn't write all the Stella episodes, but do you still have quite a strong hand on those episodes in terms of input?
Yes, and I probably was really annoying, actually, because I used to stick my big oar in, and I think I probably annoyed a few of the writers, and I apologize to them now, because it must have been a bit frustrating for them. But it's just that sometimes I think, oh no, but they wouldn't say that. Wouldn't say that. But then by the same token, the other writers would come up with some brilliant ideas that I would go, oh, I'd never have thought of that. or some really funny lines. And I go, oh, that's so funny. But yeah, I think because I suppose I was the showrunner for it really as well. So I did have a there was one series that I tried to stand back, which was series four. I tried not to get as involved in that one, but I just couldn't help it.
Well, it must have been difficult not to be involved when you're in it. It's not as if you can just like go on holiday for a couple of months and come back and see what they've done because you're bang in the middle of it, aren't you?
Yes, that's true, actually. That is true. And I loved it as well.
And when you've conceived something as well, which you did, you created, I think, you've got this umbrella eye view, haven't you, over it. It's slightly different, I think. I can understand that.
I was really fortunate to be able to go to the in post-production. So I was able to, with Stella and with Gavin and Stacey, actually, but with Stella, I was able to go to the edit and the sound dub. So that was great. I loved the post-production. I absolutely loved it because it was like, you know, you've had a seed and you've planted this little plant and you've just watched it grow and blossom. And it's just lovely to see the whole process through from the very beginning to the end. And I just loved it.
Do you miss your characters when you stop writing them?
I do. I mean, Stella... I haven't. Occasionally, I'll have a little binge on Stella. I've done it maybe twice, and I've watched the whole thing through, and I just think, oh, she was great. She was because that was more comedy drama than sort of out and out comedy. Although I don't think Gavin and Stacey is out and out comedy because that does have some drama in it. But I think because Nessa is perhaps a more striking character than Stella, Nessa it still kind of lives on. And I mean, and also during COVID, I actually put the whole gear on. Because, you know, I was like stuck at home bored, but I put the whole Nessa gear on and I filmed in this room, actually. I filmed one of those messages, a social distancing message. And it was all, just because you don't feel ill, don't mean you're not infected. You could be riddled. And it was like, if you see me doing my daily 5K around Barry, don't be thinking of breaking that 2 meter rule. And it was like, because I will not hesitate in telling you to back off. and so I did that, and that was good fun. That was really good fun. So,
I think Nessa is one of the best characters of all time. Yeah. I just think she is wonderful. It's such a brilliant creation. I mean, I know you wrote the series, but do you feel that she's a bit like your alter ego? I mean, was she just like then? You were just brilliant. Does she just rise up like a phoenix? Does she just sort of come out?
She absolutely does. And what's great about her is she doesn't care about annoying people or telling people what she thinks. So she will do things that I would never in a million years have the courage to do. And so I did a charity event about, I think it was in 2018, and it was for the RNLI. And I basically hosted this whole evening as Nessa. And it was a black tie event. There was, you know, 200 odd people there, sit down dinner. And we had like only men allowed singing. We had Bonnie Tyler. It was a great, really great evening. And Rob Brydon made a surprise entry and sang Islands in the Stream with me. It was great fun. But, you know, people started to get a bit rowdy towards the end of the night, and we had this auction coming up. And if I'd been as me, I couldn't have quietened people down. But it was great because as Nessa, I can just go, oh, I'm not standing up here for the benefit of my health. Now shut it. You know,
it could
be so rude. And the same thing when we were filming, when we did the Christmas special, we were filming in the arcade and people were lovely. I mean, people came from all over the country to come and watch filming. But it did mean there was quite a lot of noise outside. And so I did have to go out in character and just sort of say, now look, I'm very happy to meet you afterwards, but you've got to shut up, all right? You're making too much noise. We're trying to make a film in there. And it was great. People were like, oh yeah, okay. So yeah, it's quite good. It's quite liberating, actually.
It's brilliant. I mean, it's brilliant because I read that, you know, for that last Christmas special, it was 18 million viewings for that. Yes. Do you ever have to pinch yourself? I mean, you've been so successful and quite rightly so, but do you ever have to pinch yourself and think, oh, blimey, how did I get here? How has this happened? Or are you beyond all that now?
It's just that I haven't really done anything in the last few years acting wise, because the Christmas special was probably the last thing I did actually on TV. I haven't done any TV. I've been writing my novels. And it's funny because when I read the novel in my novels, when I read the you know, they do a little bump at the back and say Ruth Jones is best known for playing, you know, do all this kind of thing. When I look at my other credits, they're all like from 10 years ago or something, like, you know, when I did Tess of the D'Urbervilles or Little Dorrit or something, but I haven't really done anything since. So I just feel a little bit of a fraud because I just think, oh God, well, you know, I know obviously Stella, but Stella finished in 2016, 2017, something like that. So I just think, I don't know, I don't feel, I'm very aware of Gavin and Stacey as a success. It's been huge and it's just brilliant. And Stella, I'm really, really chuffed about it. And my novels, I'm really chuffed. But I suppose I take it all. I think I do get a little bit of the old imposter syndrome, if I'm honest. And I do just go, really? Oh, I don't think I'm that good. So I don't know, but it's and I'm not being fake. I'm not doing a
I just think it's interesting. It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you wake up one morning and think, oh gosh, you know, I've this huge body of work, and it is a huge body of work. I mean, it's just fantastic. Mm. Because am I right in thinking that before you did Gavin and Stacey, you hadn't written before? Is that right?
I did write, actually. I wrote because so Kay Mellor, we did. So James and I met on a series called Fat Friends, which was on ITV in 2000. I think we met. And Kay Mellor, God rest her soul, was very encouraging of new writers. And I remember by about series, I think in between series one and two, there was quite a big gap, and I started writing, trying to write TV scripts then, just sort of, you know, doing my own thing. I wrote something that it wasn't terribly good, but I sent it to her and she gave me some really positive feedback. And I offered up an episode for series four, I think it was, of Fat Friends, and it got commissioned. So I did do an episode of Fat Friends. That was the first thing that I did. And then Kay went on to write a series called The Chase, but not The Chase that everybody knows. Mm-hmm. And it was about a veterinary practice, and I wrote an episode of that, and it was quite funny actually, because I can't remember who the actor was, but I met somebody years later who was in The Chase, and I said you were in The Chase, weren't you? And he said yes. I said, oh, it was a great series, that. And he said, oh yeah, he said, but some of the storylines, oh my god. He said one time we had a storyline where somebody brought in a snake that that was constipated, and I went, yeah, I wrote that episode.
Brilliant.
I was commissioned to two proper scripts, and then I'd written something off my own bat that never came to anything before that. So, but Gavin and Stacey was the main thing, really.
Mm. We do want to talk about the novels because you've mentioned them, shall we? But we need to do a shout out to your mate Liz, Sonny.
Oh, yes, my lovely mate Liz Stone, who is the reason that Ruth, you are sitting with us today, because dear Liz was coming to your book signing, wasn't she, in Abergavenny, I think it was, for Love Untold, which was your last book. And she said to her, and I said, oh, Ruth Jones, I'd love her to come on the podcast. I don't know how I could get to contact her and, you know, what have you. And she said, because you sound very like Liz, actually. She said, oh, well, I'll ask her. I said, we can't do that. She said, well, why not? She could only say no. So bless her heart. So I just want to say thank you, Liz Stone, who's one of my oldest friends, for being very, very brave and taking the opportunity. And thank you, Ruth, for responding to me. We are very, very grateful.
Thank
so there
you,
we go.
Well done.
Yeah. No,
and it was lovely to meet you in Abergavenny.
That was a signing for Love Untold, which is, if there's anybody listening who's not read it, bloody marvellous. I mean, all three books are marvellous, but I think that, I can't say too much about it because I don't want to give it away, but it's a brilliant piece of writing. It's so clever. Did not see the end coming. You didn't either, did you, Sunny?
No, did not at all. Did not at all.
Thank you. I mean, it's for people who haven't read it, it's about four generations of women, a great-grandmother, a grandmother, a mother and a daughter. And I mean, obviously, so three daughters, three mothers. And it's set in Wales. They're a Welsh family. And it's really about a rift that happened 30 years ago between the oldest member of the family, Grace, and her daughter, Alice, and her daughter. So it's whether that rift can be fixed before Grace, who's about to turn 90, has her birthday. And it was it's funny because when I wrote Us Three, I was really, because that spanned about four decades, and I thought, right, I mustn't write something that goes over several decades for the next book. I must try and keep it in the day and just, you know, over a couple of months or something. And I ended up writing, I think it expanded even more. I think it was like five decades that it spanned over. But I love a good sort of family saga. I think that's what it is. That's why I was interested in doing it.
It's really, really clever. And the thing is, you write, Sunny and I get so pissed off with the way that older women are written, because we're all sort of written off as being like incontinent no-hopers, and we're not, you know, we're not entirely incontinent yet. But you write younger women brilliantly, obviously, but you write older women so well. And it's a very, very, very rare thing. And honestly, as one gets older, it's very, very nice to see people of one's own age and older being represented as kind of compos mentis and a part of society.
Oh, thank you. Well, I really wanted to do that because, I mean, there were several things that sort of contributed to the story, but one of them was that I did Who Do You Think You Are for BBC, and it followed both my grandfathers, because I never knew either of my grandfathers. And my mother's father died when my mother was two, so she didn't know her father really at all. But his family were all from Newquay in West Wales, and I didn't know this. So I spent a couple of days there, and actually Dylan's Quay in the book is Newquay, really. I mean, I based it on Newquay because I've had such a connection with the whole place. So that was that. But then also when I explored my other grandfather, my father's father's side of the family, there were these love letters that were written to my grandmother by my grandfather, and they were just what I couldn't get over them with was how they were so sort of modern, and they were quite not risque, but well, they were actually a little bit, like, you know, things like I can't stop thinking about you lying in my arms last night, and just and calling her bit and saying like an expression like baby, sort of like a term of affection. Just it was all very, very modern and not how I imagined, you know, because to me, my grandmother was this little old lady who used to put several scarves around her head to sort of keep her head warm when she walked down to our house. But she was this very vibrant, alive, glamorous young woman, you know, who was got married in 1926 and had this beautiful wedding dress. And I just think, you know, you're quite right. We automatically, the younger generation, I don't want to make generalizations, but I feel, and I probably did it myself, that you kind of get written off by younger people, you're just old. And I remember talking to my niece about something, like a, you know, kind of a relationship thing that was going on. And I said, I do know what you're going through, you know, I do understand. And she was, oh, no, you don't. And I'm going, no, but I do, because in my mind, I'm still your age. I'm still a teenager. So I wanted to create a character so that the main character in the book is You know, Grace is nearly 90. She does yoga. She does Pilates. She walks everywhere. She still drives, and she goes swimming in the sea. And when I told my mother that, who's 87, she went, "Oh well, that's just ridiculous. Nobody will ever believe that."
Well, we did. We completely did.
You know. Yeah, and I think as well with those older characters within the book as well, because they. You know, they are, aren't they? There's also three of them particularly. But you write with the essence. You write about the essence of the character, the soul of the character. It's mm-hmm. You know, immediately you know who you're with. And I'm inside them as a reader. You know, it's not an external experience. I'm completely inside those characters on that journey. And it's such a gift to be able to do that. Was there always a novelist in you, think, Ruth? Did you...
No, I don't think there was. I'm an accidental novelist, because when I told you about that period of time when I started writing TV scripts, I wrote a script, but probably, gosh, it was about 2000, I think it was 2002, something like that. And it was a two-parter, and nothing came of it. I think I tried to get an agent through it, sent it away. Nobody was really interested. And I forgot all about it. And then about, 8 years ago now, I found it again on my laptop, and I reread it. And although there was a lot wrong with it, the story was really good. And I just thought, as an experiment, I would try adapting it to prose fiction, and just as a labor of love, really. And I loved the process. I really, really enjoyed it. And I did about 10,000 words. And then I thought, oh, I wonder if this is, I couldn't tell whether it was any good or not, because I couldn't be objective enough about it. So I happened to be I was still in touch with a friend of mine from university who was a literary agent, who's a really big literary agent now, Johnny Geller. And he I said, can I get some advice? And he ended up taking me on as a client, and there was like a bidding war for this book, which was I did not see that one coming. The slight issue at the time was, are people going to think my first novel is going to be like Gavin and Stacey or Stella? Mm. And it's just going to be, is it going to be comedic? And and of course, for people who've read Nevergreener, I probably couldn't write that novel now. It's really quite sort of, you know, the central character is not very pleasant, really. And it's quite hedonistic, and it's a lot of sex in it. And which is why I couldn't read the audio book, because I kept imagining my listening to me describing this sort of graphic sex. So, but people were, it was well received, and went to number one in the Sunday Times charts. I was very, very, very chuffed about. But thankfully, I think generally people didn't expect, as I thought they might, they didn't expect it to be like Gavin and Stacey. So that was good. That was good.
Because the central character, it's Kate, isn't it? And
yes.
And, yeah. Yes. I mean, she's not a nice person, but I still wanted to read about her. So,
yeah.
You know, I still turning the pages going, what is she going to do next? In Us Three, Lana's not always particularly nice, is she? But again, it's like, well, I want to know more. I want to know what she's going to do next, because you still get the soul of them somehow, even though they're baddies.
Yes.
Yeah. Going back to Ambridge, it's a bit like George Grundy, isn't it? I mean, he's a baddie, but I kind of want to know what he's doing next. And it's the same. You very cleverly write these characters that are so engaging, even though they're not the goodies.
Alice is a bit like that, isn't she, in Love Untold? Mm. She's not.
And all three of those characters, I actually think they're really interesting characters, and they've all got issues with alcohol, all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
Made them really interesting. And it's funny because they, certainly with Kate and with Lana, they're both actresses. And so people then are going, oh, is it based on you? And no, it's not based on me. But obviously I know about that world of TV filming. And one of the things I really did enjoy doing in Nevergreener was writing the awards night, the awards ceremony,
yeah.
with people being on coke and just yes. repeating themselves and gurning and that kind of thing. So yeah, there was a lot of life experience in there that I picked up on the way.
Yeah, they really are.
They're
terrific.
Very different experience. Oh, they are. Yeah, fabulous. But it's a different experience, isn't it? Bit writing a solitary, you know, and a novel from doing the scripts for Stella and Gavin and Stacey. I mean, was it a very different technique that you applied, or did you just enter that world effortlessly?
Yeah, I think it is solitary. That's the thing about it, the big difference. But also you get a lot more freedom with a novel because obviously you don't have the restrictions of locations, actor availability, time slots on screen. So, you know, apart from, you know, you can't really write sort of 200,000 words. You've got a roughly between 80 and 100,000 words, but that's pretty much it. So and it was a lovely process, and certainly the first novel I went to a place in Bungay where they in Suffolk where they print the books, and I said, oh, I'd really like to go and see the book, you know, the final thing being done. And I went there and I was expecting it to be like, you know, a little man with a pile of books sort of putting a cover on it. And it was this huge factory process of all these books going along this conveyor belt and the covers being put on them. And I took one out and I just wrote in it. I said, this is the first book of mine that I have held in my hands. And it's so exciting to have this experience. And then I put it back into the whole process. Somebody somewhere has got that novel.
It'll be worth a fortune. My goodness gracious, how fantastic.
So lovely.
Yeah, it was a really lovely thing to do. And of course, you know, it'll never be experienced again because that was my first one and that was that. But no, it was lovely. And I love the world of publishing. I've worked with a really lovely team in Transworld is the my publisher, and they're part of Penguin Random House. And it's been a joy to work with them on all the novels so far. So, yes, onwards.
And is there another one? Is there another novel now?
In number four at the moment. Number four is I've written the first draft, and I'm just working on the notes. So, and it's different. But another kind of like I won't say too much, but I think, we'll see. I'm enjoying it because it's slightly different stylistically. So that's made it quite nice.
Now with another, you know, Ruth Jones hat on, you're going into the West End. You're opening in the West End, aren't you? In March.
I know. How
sister
is
act.
That? I know. I know. So we're doing, I mean, I literally, that did not, I was, that was not part of the plan. I don't really have a plan. That's the thing. And this, I was offered an email coming and said, would you consider the part of Mother Superior in Sister Act? And I was like, I'm not a Mother Superior. Why are they thinking? I actually thought, have they made a mistake? And there was various sort of to-ing and fro-ing, and met with the producer. And I really wasn't sure, but they were very keen for me to do it. And I think it will be different, maybe a different version. I think the good thing about the character of Mother Superior is that she's open to sort of interpretation. So yeah. Jennifer Saunders has played her, and Sheila Hancock obviously played her in the first West End run. So, I'm excited, really excited to do it. But I've never been in I was in musicals in school, but I've never done a professional musical. And I've never been in the West End before, so it's and I'm really chuffed that at 57 I'm going to be a West End Wendy. I can't wait.
Fantastic! Yeah. Fantastic! Are you rehearsing at the minute?
Please do come and see it.
Oh, we'd love to. So, are you rehearsing at the minute then, Ruth? Or
no. So I'm going to Dublin with a tour. So there's a tour going on, and then there'll be the London production. So okay. I'm doing a bit of both. So I'm doing I'm going to Dublin in February. I think February the 13th. I think we're there for 2 weeks, and then I come back and rehearse for the London the London version. So, so I've been having a few singing lessons and learning my lines. That's the thing. That's my thing is remembering lines on stage, because I haven't done theatre for that precise reason in recent years, because I just I don't know how you feel about, but the thought of doing. I did a play in 2018, and I remember at the time thinking, I must never accept a theatre job again, because it's just too stressful trying to remember lines. But, you know, it's worse things in life.
It is tough. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I completely understand where you're coming from. And many, many years ago, I did Shirley Valentine many, many years ago. And I terrified myself so much, because, you know, you're on stage 2.5 hours on your own, blinking, you know, one person monologue. Yeah. And it's really... I get you, but you'll be fabulous. You will be fabulous. But I do understand. Oh. I do understand where you're coming from with it. I do.
Yes. It's we'll March, continue. Isn't it? March 15th. March 15th. Is that right?
Or the 18th. I think it's the 18th.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's
with Beverly Knight, who her voice is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, it's just amazing, her voice. So I can't, because we did a thing for the Royal Variety Show. We did Raise Your Voice, which is one of the songs. We did that for the Royal Variety Show. I didn't perform the song, but I did a little sort of sketch beforehand with Bradley Walsh. And and I loved that, because it got me to dive in at the deep end with, I got to meet some of the cast and just be in the Albert Hall on stage. It doesn't frighten me being on stage. It's just because I do book events with quite a lot of people in the audience, and that doesn't bother me, because it's not a script then. It's just, you know, talking. But it's just, yeah. But I'm gonna think positively. I will remember more.
you will be fine. I mean, it's just the actor's nightmare, isn't it, really? We sort of terrify ourselves, but it's always fine. It's always fine. It's just, you know.
Yes.
And the adrenaline sort of, you know, pushes you through, and, you know, I hope the habit is comfortable. Yeah. I hope that habit is comfortable, Ruth.
It is. I think the box bit on my head might need a little adjusting. That's the bit that kind of clings to your head a little bit. But the rest of it is quite nice, actually. It covers a multitude of sins. And, you know, I can hide all sorts up there, really, for, you know, tin of biscuits for half time.
Oh, that's great. So one of the questions that we ask our guests is, because we're getting towards the end of this podcast, and bless your heart for doing this with us, is there anything, or what would you say to your younger self if you could?
Well, do you know, it's probably, I often think about this, because I can look back at my life and I just go, oh, Ruth, why did you not realise what you had then? And, you know, it's like when you look at photographs of yourself when you're younger, and I look at, this is what breaks my heart with teenage girls, particularly, where they think that they look awful. And, you know, I can remember, I just thought, oh, God, I'm so fat. I used to have this whole thing. Well, in fact, I wasn't skinny, but I wasn't fat. But, you know, I look at photos of myself and I just think, oh, you were gorgeous. Why did you not realise? Why were you so down on yourself? And I wish that we all could appreciate ourselves really more. And so I think there's that. And there's also the confidence. I would say to my younger self now, you've got it all there. You've got it all there. Believe in yourself. Believe in yourself. Honestly, you really have got a lot going for yourself. Just keep believing. Because I was so down on myself when I was younger. I really was. And what a waste of time. Because before you know it, you know, you're 57 and you're looking back and going, oh, why didn't I make realize potential I had. I think that's the thing, really. And also, I always say, today is the youngest I'm ever going to be. this is the youngest I'm ever going to be. So enjoy it. Make them, because you can look back now at a photo of, say, 10 years ago. Oh, gosh. Yeah. Where did those 10 years go? Yeah. So I have reached a point in life now where I'm going to, where I do try to, it sounds a little bit twee, but I do try to enjoy and make the most of each day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with this challenge with Sister Act, for example, yeah, I'm going to enjoy that challenge. So, yeah. Sorry, I've really answered you in a very long-winded way, and you probably wanted something very precise. Yeah. I would say to my younger self, believe in yourself. Yeah. Believe in yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would hope that I would listen.
So fantastic advice. So right. Wise words. No, it is wise words. And it is about seizing the day, isn't it? You know, and just sort of going for it. But yes, we're so down on ourselves when we're younger, aren't we, actually? And it's...
Yes.
I think we all do it. I look back at photographs and I think, what's wrong with you? You are absolutely fine, you know. But there we are. But I can't tell you how thrilling this has been to actually speak to you. It really, really has, because we both admire you so much, you know, as a performer, as a writer, but actually as a human being. I just think you are so delightful and so you still. And that, you know, you've had such huge success. You could be very different. You're just delightful. So bless you for coming back to me.
I've really enjoyed it. It's been lovely. It's been just like hanging out with a couple of friends and having a little Friday night. So I've really enjoyed myself, and it's been lovely to meet you both.
To meet you, and we will try and get to see Sister Act, and you know
we will definitely see
you know,
Sister Act.
And I'll email you to that. Not that you necessarily have to come and say hello to us, but to tell you that we're in.
Please do. Yeah. You must come and say hello. You must come and see me close up in my habit.
We'll pinch your biscuits.
That's right. Yes. And you can show us, you know, what draws these habits. I mean, I don't know what do nuns wear beneath their habits, or should we not go into that? Is that for another podcast?
That's very interesting. I could tell you, but I would be giving away trade secrets.
Secrets. We don't want that. But look, thank you. You've had a really busy day. Thank you so much, Ruth, for joining us today. It's been great. And just to reiterate, you're going to be at the Dominion Theatre as the Reverend Mother in Sister Act from March to, I think it's the 8th of June. I think there may be the odd little performance that you're not doing. Is that right? So people need to go to the website
I'm not doing it. Yeah, I'm not doing it the 9th to the 13th because my stepdaughter is having her delayed wedding, which she was meant to have in COVID, and they've had two children since then. So so we're going to France for that. So, But please do come and see it, everyone. It's a really great show. It's a really uplifting show. So just to come and see it.
Yeah.
Thank you again for asking me onto your lovely podcast.
Thank you so much for coming,
Take
Ruth.
Care.
Thank
Lots
you.
Of love, Ruth. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to our One Stiletto in the Grey podcast. If you'd like to see behind-the-scenes clips and bonus content, please visit our Facebook page, One Stiletto in the Grey podcast. And if you'd like to ask any questions, follow us on Twitter at OneStiletto65. This podcast is produced by Raggedy House Productions and the music composed by Tom Smith. See you next time!